All right, we're going to get started. Thank you all very much for coming. We want to honor the time that we have here together. We'll be having a conversation here after some prepared remarks from each of our three panelists today. And in the interim, maybe we'll have a conversation here on stage and then start to take questions. As I understand it, there's note cards that are available. So as they're speaking, each of the panelists, please feel free to maybe just signal and grab a note card. There's also this fancy app for those of you with an inclination for an online submission. And so then we will discuss some of the issues that are involved with this theme. So today is April 12th. It is 9 a.m., and this is panel number 4101, entitled Saving the Planet, All Countries on Deck. And so, generally speaking, the panelists will each have about 5 minutes to have their opening remarks, and then we'll take it from there. So in this, I think I said this in a different sort of phrasing, but there is a prepared phrasing that is available to remind you to utilize the Conference on World Affairs app. And if you do that, tap Q&A and then insert, and then also make sure that you send your questions along. So my name is Max Boykoff. I'm a director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research here at the University of Colorado. That center is within a larger institute called the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences, CERES. And so I've been a fan of these panels and Conference on World Affairs for many years. So it's an honor for me to get to sit here with the three of these folks today. The order in which we're going to go is first we're going to hear from Alexander Verbeek. Secondly, we're going to hear from Lisa Fries. And then finally, we're going to hear from Cassandra Brooks. And so just to introduce Alexander in short, there's much you can say about Alexander and all the wonderful work that he's done over decades. He's an associate at the Stockholm Environment Institute and the Stockholm International Water Institute. He was formerly a strategic advisor at the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He is a self-described Dutch environmentalist, public speaker, and undeniably a diplomat, working in the areas of international security, humanitarian geopolitical risk issues, and the linkage to the Earth's accelerating environmental crisis. Currently, he is an expert speaker and advisor, covering issues of planetary change for areas of academia, global environmental organizations, private firms, and international NGOs. Thank you, Alexander. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Max. Great to be back here, and thank you all for coming so early. Look at this title, Saving the Planet, All Countries on Deck. We've got about an hour to save the planet to discuss about that, right? Wow. Where do we start? You know, the challenges are so huge. I'm talking about the oceans, for instance. Every single minute, a truckload of plastic is thrown in the ocean. Talking about plastic, we've produced more cling film. You know, the stuff you use in your kitchen to preserve stuff. We've produced more cling film than we've produced enough to wrap the complete planet in cling film. We're now for the second layer. We're discussing these kind of challenges. Look about biodiversity. I remember when I was a kid and we went on holiday, that at every gas stop that we made, it was my task to get out of the car and clean the windshield of all the bugs that were there. You still remember? I see a lot of nodding. And I see some young people looking at, what? Well, actually, there were so many. Yeah, that was you. You were not nodding. There are just so many bugs that, you know, you had to clean the headlights because otherwise they didn't work anymore. They're all gone. I remember the butterflies in the garden when I was young. And there are no more butterflies in the same garden when I still go there. There's just so much happening on this planet. And then the biggest elephant in the room is, of course, climate change. The scientists tell us, and they're all in agreement, don't let you be fooled that they're not in agreement. The climate scientists tell us that we have 11 years left to halve the emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions that we produce, for instance, by driving your car and by burning fossil fuels. And if we do that, then we can stay within limits that kind of save our planet and keep the planet as a place where we can live and enjoy the beauty. We cannot keep it as it is, but at least we can keep it kind of livable. That is a massive challenge. Last year, emissions were going up some 2 to 3%. So how do we turn that around? Well, as the title says, we need all countries on deck. And not only all countries, we need all hands on deck, everybody. You can do things at your individual level, at the community level. But countries need to do a lot. We don't get there, as a diplomat, I can say that we don't get there if the countries don't work together. And I've seen in my diplomatic life fantastic examples where when the countries do work together, we can actually solve things. Do you remember the acid rain in, what was it, 1980s? Everybody was scared about acid rain. Now some climate deniers used it as, there were the days that we were scared about acid rain and that was a complete hoax that went over. Well, no, it was not. It was because the countries worked together, because we took the right measures. We have solved that problem. Do you remember the hole in the ozone layer? Same story, it didn't heal by itself. All the countries, as well as the industries, as well as NGOs, they all sat together and they worked out a treaty to say that those gases that created that hole in the ozone layer, that we changed them for other materials, and now the hole is repairing itself. Might take another 50 years or so, but we're on the right track. So when we do work together, and when we recognize the science, and when we work with the countries, as well as the business community, as well as individuals, we can do so much beautiful things. Let me give you a last example. I worked as a diplomat for many years on the issue of landmines. That was especially in the 1990s, where NGOs like Handicap International said at a certain moment, we have now so many men, women and children with their legs being blown off. It's crazy that we're just repairing and trying to heal these people and save their lives. We have to go to the source of the problem. We have to get rid of landmines. And then a lot of governments were reluctant, said, we need them to fight our wars. But then the NGOs united, and they started a massive campaign, and they convinced the governments that it's actually possible to get rid of landmines. Some, I won't mention names here, but some very important and influential countries refused to go on board. But then all the other countries said, well, we forget about the big countries. We just, with the countries that want to work on this, we get together. And we created the Ottawa Convention. And immediately afterwards, they got the Nobel Prize for that, the NGOs that arranged this. Immediately afterwards, you saw that the numbers of victims annually of landmines were dramatically going down. So things that look like an impossible task, you can actually solve it if you get everybody on board. So I'd like to stop there as opening statement. Thanks.
Thank you, Alexander. Next, we'll hear from Lisa Fries, who is an atmospheric science PhD student at Massachusetts Institute for Technology. She focuses on the intersection of atmospheric science and international relations, specifically researching air pollution, health, and economics in China, in the U.S., and other developing regions. So before she was at MIT, she worked at the Wilson Center's China Environment Forum in Washington, D.C., as well as the Rock Environment and Energy Institute in Beijing, and Green Camel Bell in Lanzhou, China. Is that correct? Close.
Yeah.
You can correct me then. The last thing I'm going to say, though, is just looking up a little bit to learn about, this is the first time that we're meeting, I did go on your Twitter bio, and it says, otherwise in the mountains eating guac and making bad jokes.
Thank you for bringing up my nice little Twitter presence, which is preceded by a lot of kind of feminist STEM statements, as well as focus on air pollution and climate change. So today I kind of wanted to open talking a bit about I'm fortunate enough to still be taking classes, which I take as a huge blessing. I know some undergrads may differ in opinion from me right now. But I'm taking this class where we've been talking a lot about science, technology, and international affairs, and kind of how you can bring together different countries. And one of the key problems that you face is the fact that each country is going to have a local focus within kind of cities or towns. And then you're also going to have regional, and then you're going to have national, and then you're going to have the international initiative. So you're really trying to bring together all of these differing components and all of these different motivations and motives and bring them together under one international treaty or focus so that we can look at something like climate change, which is impacting actually mostly at the local level. It's where you see it. One interesting example I always like to use for that is a lot of time with my work in China. We would find that most of the time you look at China and a lot of people are like, they're doing such great steps on tackling pollution and climate change, and they're really being honest about it. And this is not at all to throw shade. I think that China is really moving forward in this field. But that's very much at the national level. That's what we're hearing in America. Then you go down to the local level, and you have kind of local politicians who are allowing for pollution to continue to occur, emissions to continue to increase, new coal plants to be built. And so those are very different, just within a country itself, very different motivations. And so then you bring that into the international sphere, and it gets a little bit even harder. So I want to bring that back, actually, to why I ended up choosing to study what I study. And that will make sense in the light of getting all hands on deck regarding climate change. I worked in or lived in China while I was doing my undergraduate degree and saw a lot of air pollution. And I found myself very frustrated by the fact that I was able to look forward to leaving. I had a deadline, a timeline, where I was going to be out of the dirty air, and I knew I was going to be able to breathe the nice clean air that we have in the U.S. But all of my friends who are Chinese did not. And so that kind of hit me really hard. And I always had been thinking about how I could approach the issue of climate change from a science as well as policy standpoint, and how I could approach it so that it felt tangible. And that tangibility came through something that you could see physically, which was air pollution, and something that impacted people very personally, which is through their health or their economic impacts. And so that actually brings me to something that Alexander had brought up. I'm fortunate enough to work in or go to school in a department with Susan Solomon, who was one of the key finders of the ozone hole. She found out one of the critical kind of chemical mechanisms by which the ozone hole was being formed. And she recently wrote this great interview where she pointed out why she is hopeful regarding climate change, and a lot of it ties back to how the Montreal Protocol regarding the ozone hole followed through. And I really like the way she broke it down into kind of three key components, which was number one, making it personal. This is something that I know motivated what my work is, bringing it down to each individual person's level and making sure that even if you don't think climate change is impacting you yet, it really is, and it's going to just increase. And we see that a lot in more impoverished, more marginalized communities already, but I think that we need to stop seeing that rhetoric as afar off and start thinking about it, how it impacts our personal lives here. And also an important aspect of that is, and I'm a scientist speaking to a lot of people about this, but I think one of the critical things is moving beyond just having scientists talk to people about this and having someone who is local and trusted within a community who is able to kind of communicate on this issue, because that really is where the personal connections come in. The second thing she brought up is that it needs to be perceptible. So for me, that was looking at things from air pollution, because a lot of air pollution is coupled with the emissions that cause air pollution also are from the emissions that have carbon dioxide coming out. So a lot of these issues are very tied together, and they actually play off of each other. And so bringing it so that we can physically see it, be it through people looking at plastics in the ocean, through visualizations, through images, through whatever it is, we need to make it more perceptible. And the third idea is that it needs to be practical. There are so many discussions about how we are just never going to be able to approach tackling climate change, and I think that idea is very poorly stated. It is going to be a very difficult challenge, and that's not to be understated. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of collaboration from businesses, governments, people on the ground, citizens, scientists, around the world, and that is what we're here to talk about. But in the end, there are practical solutions. We have a lot of the technology we need, and the technology that we don't have, that we still need, rather than continuing to use past technologies and state that this is an issue, we need to invest in the future. We've faced similar standpoints where we have questioned whether or not we're going to be able to move forward, and always investing in innovation and relying on that is a huge component. So lastly, I just want to kind of bring it back. I think we were chatting about the title a little bit earlier, and I think there is one thing that when you think about saving the planet, I struggle with thinking about it that way, because we're not really saving the planet. The planet is here. It has survived a lot of changes throughout history. There's been a lot of climactic changes. There's been a lot. The planet is fine. We are the problem. And I think that thinking about it in that rhetoric, thinking about it as more so working together so that we can create a habitable planet for future generations. So bringing it back to the local citizens and how we all can get together and how we all can ensure that the politics at the local level, because the local level is really where a lot of it is going to happen, but then the local level up to regional, up to national, so that then it kind of trickles forward to international.
Thank you very much, Lissa. Sorry about that before. Next up, we have Cassandra Brooks, who I'm happy to call a colleague here at the university. She is on faculty in environmental studies at CU Boulder. She draws heavily on a number of different disciplines, including marine science, environmental policy, science communication, to really focus in on the problems and to seek solutions in this 21st century environment. So she's a marine scientist. She's an expert in environmental governance. She has worked as a science journalist and has therefore made inroads into many of these different communities and many of the connections between them, publishing in top journals like Science and Nature, but then also meeting people where they are on the ground through a lot of her other work. So over to you.
Thanks, Max, and thanks everyone for coming out today. I know the weather is really cold, so we appreciate you being here. I do work at the intersection of all these disciplines, as Max mentioned, but it's largely focused on Antarctica for the last 15 years. And the reason for that is a few reasons. One is that how many of you have been to Antarctica in the room? That's amazing. So for those of you who've been, you know that it's this captivating place that really draws you in. So I started as a scientist studying Antarctic fish. And then once I learned about actually Antarctic governance, I took a big turn and started studying the policy process. And I'm going to share with you briefly the story of the Antarctic Treaty. We've heard about the Montreal Protocol being a big environmental success, and that's the one that stopped the ozone hole from growing. And I'd like to share with you the treaty one, because it's not just about the environment down there. So back at the height of the Cold War in the 1950s, Antarctica was the last country that was unclaimed, but it was being divided like a pie. All these different countries were planting flags, sending explorers, sending scientists, mapping it out, and trying to stake their claim to Antarctica, to the point that if you looked at a map of Antarctica from the 1950s, you would see it looks indeed like a pie with nine different countries dividing it up. What was also happening in the 1950s at the height of the Cold War was this arms race between the USSR and the United States. And both those countries were starting to use Antarctica for military purposes. The U.S. was literally sending up to 4,000 troops at a time down to Antarctica to actually train them to fight from this icy southern continent. And incredibly, instead of blowing ourselves up or blowing up Antarctica, we actually, all those countries came together that were having claims and working in Antarctica, and they convened a meeting and signed a peace treaty. This treaty was signed in 1959. It came into force in 1961, and it is the first post-World War II arms limitation agreement. It's still in force. It bans all nuclear activity, so Antarctica is this huge nuclear-free zone. It bans all military activity, and later agreements actually banned mining and set provisions for protecting the entire continent. And it also suspended all sovereignty claims. And this means that Antarctica now belongs to everybody. It truly is a global commons. And I want us to pause and think about that. We had this continent that countries were fighting over, including global powers. And instead of continuing to fight over it, we actually set it aside for the sake of humanity. And for me, once I learned about that, it gave me so much hope that, oh my gosh, we did this. We did this in Antarctica. We can do this in other places. And I realized this was what feels like a long time ago, but it really wasn't that long ago. And I've seen recent examples that show that this is still possible. Over the last 12 years, I spent a lot of my career working towards the protection of a specific place in Antarctica called the Ross Sea. And if you haven't heard of the Ross Sea, my husband John Weller is a photographer who actually coined it as the last ocean. And we created this global project where we produced a documentary film, which actually was shown here at the BIFF and won an award here. And we created a flood of media and we branded this place as the last ocean. But then we had to get inside and get the international governments to agree to protecting this place. And it took many, many years. It took getting all the different countries that work in Antarctica on board to agree to protecting this place. But incredibly, I was in the room in 2016. My husband and I were both in the room when countries came together and by unanimous consensus adopted the world's largest marine protected area in the Ross Sea, Antarctica. And being in the room among all these very serious, usually older men, diplomats, and negotiations tend to be very serious. They talk about a lot of different things. We have to keep Antarctica military free. We have to keep it a place of peace and science. And in this moment when we got consensus to adopt the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area, the room actually exploded in applause. And we had countries hugging other countries, China hugging Russia, Russia hugging the U.S., countries that don't normally get along. And this was 2016, and relations between Russia and the U.S. were really poor that year. And I distinctly remember being in the room and thinking, we're not going to get this because there's no way that these countries are going to agree. But they did. And it brought home for me remembering that at least in Antarctica, we have this framework to actually to set aside national interests and really focus on global peace and science. However, that said, I think it's important to realize that in the case of Antarctica, it really was the threat of nuclear war that frightened people so much. I mean, headlines at the time were literally calling Antarctica this red space, that it was going to become this red space back in the 1950s. And that's a very real fear for people, right? I mean, it continues to be a real fear. And the Montreal Protocol was similar. People were really scared of getting skin cancer and actually dying from this ozone hole. And for me, it brings home that it has to be not about saving the planet, as Lissa said. It has to be about saving us. The planet will continue to be here. It really is about making sure we have a future and we have a planet that we can live on. And I feel that we need to think about climate change in the same vein. And how we don't is surprising to me, that if we don't actually get a handle on climate change and get a handle on carbon emissions, then it is a threat to our human survival. And we really need to see it that way. And that really takes a shift in how we see our relationship to the environment, really understanding that it is about us and our relationship to the planet. And I just want to close with bringing to you the idea of half Earth. Have any of you, most of you probably heard of E.O. Wilson. He's a famous biologist based in Harvard, and he's written multiple books on biodiversity. He's considered the grandfather of biodiversity. And he is now making a plea through multiple books and many projects and high-profile speaking events that in order to save us, to save humanity, we actually have to set aside half the Earth as protected areas, as areas where we're not harming. And he said the reason for that is that that will actually save enough biodiversity to ensure our survival. And I love that idea. And he is making this plea that it's about us. It's not about saving half the Earth. It's about saving us. And the only way to do that is to actually set aside half the Earth. D.O. Wilson? Yeah, you bet. Half Earth is his latest book on it. So with that, I'm really excited to take your questions and for all of us to have a conversation about how to save humanity.
Thank you, Cassandra. What I'd like to do before I start to ask some of these, they're great questions from the crowd, both through the app and on the note cards. So again, the note cards are available on both sides. Just raise your hand if you'd like one. But before I do that, I mean, having heard from each of you, you've each provided great insights and from slightly different perspectives. And I wonder if anyone has any initial comments on the panel itself to some of the things that were said by others. Alexander, you want to begin?
Well, briefly, what I noticed that maybe it was in my speech, but certainly in Lisa's and Cassandra's speeches, the beauty of the challenge. Imagine where we are now, this point in time in human history. So for 10,000 years, we've been building our, that's when we started, let's say 10,000 years ago, we built the first cities, etc., Mesopotamia. So for 10,000 years, we've built this human culture. We're now in this amazing place where you have iPhones, you have people watching in faraway places like wherever in Canada that are seeing us, talking here. And we've gone so far. And now all of this, all this culture is at a threat. That's something that we had never really foreseen decades ago, that it would get so serious. So it's an amazing challenge. I see a lot of young people in this room for that is your century. That is your challenge. And for the young people sitting here, this is actually... this is the unique thing for your generation. You're the first generation that is tasked to save this planet. You're also the last one that can really do so. If you fail, then you're just as bad as us, because my generation failed in saving it. So we got to go there. And it's inspiring to hear these examples of the Montreal Protocol or of what happened in Antarctica, that we can actually do so much. And it starts with yourself. It is for what politicians you vote for. It is what you do at home, your choices on how you heat your home, on what kind of car you drive, what kind of transportation you use. There are so many things that you yourself can do. And ultimately, it is your community, it is your country, and it is all of us on this planet working together. It's a challenge not unlike we have faced in the past when we wanted to go to the moon for the first time, which led to all kinds of innovation. Or take the Second World War, an unexpected massive threat to the world as we knew it, where we took drastic measures in the way we governed ourselves, in the innovations we did, in the corporations we did, very unlikely corporations you find between the Western Allied forces and the USSR. They hated each other, but they embraced each other together to get rid of a threat that was worse than anything else. What we need on this planet is a kind of Winston Churchill, that when your country is all alone facing odds that seem impossible to resist, and being the last one out, not being helped by anybody at that moment, still saying we will fight on and we will do whatever we can to tackle this beast and to win it, and then to finally do it, as ultimately all the Allied forces, when others came on board, like the United States, when that worked, and we created so much of a better world than the fascism that we had in the 1930s and 40s, it worked. We can do miracles. And it's a beautiful fight to be involved in, and everybody should be on board. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexander. Lisa, could I turn to you? Do you have any additional comments or observations from what's been said so far?
Yeah, I think one thing that I just wanted to kind of build on, that it became pretty apparent in this discussion about the Antarctic, is the fact that something that I've always found is a really great example also of bringing together people on this issue is the idea of the IPCC reports, which really brings together scientists. The whole idea of these reports was to bring together scientists around the world so that
researchers in Norway and researchers in China and researchers in the United States were all on the same page academically and scientifically so that they knew what was going on regarding climate change. And so it's interesting to see that the science community has really come together over a lot of these reports and how much that ties together one group. And so the question is then bringing that outwards and bringing that to other groups. And something that Alexander had brought up regarding past generations and future generations that I always like to think about too, because I'm slightly part of that future generation aspect, is thinking about the fact that when you don't know the issues that you're causing, that's a different story. But when you do know the impact that is going to occur, that's when we really start to see the need for innovation. And that's when it's our responsibility to start moving forward and really thinking about how we can tackle those issues. And kind of incorporating those through economic means, that's going to be a critical component, is kind of making sure that climate change is something that we actually feel in our daily lives.
Thank you very much. Cassandra, just some additional comments, and then we'll open it up to the questions.
Yeah, thanks. First, just a couple of clarifications, seeing some of the comments come in on the half-Earth idea by E.O. Wilson. The idea is that if you set aside half the Earth, and that does include the oceans, then you can conserve biodiversity. So the idea isn't only to conserve biodiversity in half the Earth, but that if you actually have half the Earth as protected areas or conservation areas, then you can conserve global biodiversity, just to clarify that. And just to comment, I mean, we're talking about countries on deck and international governance, but we're also talking about the connections for all of you and for local communities. And there always is a lot of questions about what can we do in our day-to-day lives to help reduce our carbon footprint or to help influence these international issues. But I really think one of the biggest things we have to do right now is to really bombard our policymakers and our diplomats and our governments. They are supposed to be representing our interests, even at the international level. And just to say that it is possible to reach out to all the people who make decisions on behalf of you and to make sure to do that, because these are international issues. They're going to affect the next generation. They're affecting us, and we really can do something about it, and that we shouldn't see international stuff as so far away and high-reaching that we can't actually influence it. But I think individual action in terms of our behavior isn't enough. We actually have to really make it clear that we want more action to happen.
Great. Thank you, Cassandra. So we have about 30 productive minutes left. I'm going to turn to questions and then some final comments again from the panelists to wrap things up. Many great questions coming in, a lot on the app. Some of these also on note cards that are available. This is a really unique intergenerational opportunity that we have to have this conversation. I'm going to begin with a question from a student. And for those of you who may want to submit, if you recognize yourself as a student, as practices are at Conference on World Affairs, there is a higher likelihood that we will ask your question. So the question is, how can developed countries ask developing countries to emit less and adopt more sustainable practices when we are responsible for the majority of the climate problems and arguably their lack of development due to colonialism and imperialism? The developed countries, especially the United States, do not practice what we preach! Exclamation point. Any initial comments from the panel?
Sounds like a diplomatic problem, huh? When you talk about climate change, soon you will hear the word that it's unfair. And that is right. It is utterly unfair. It is the rich countries that enjoyed building their economy and just freely releasing all this pollution in the air that is creating the global warming. We were far ahead of the other countries. Some of them are polluting now and some are still not doing it. The second thing that's unfair is that when you see where climate change hits the people, first and foremost, it is as exactly in those countries that contributed least to it. So you see already impacts here in the United States. Think about the forest fires in California and the massive floodings that you see increasingly happening. But take the countries in, let's say, in the Sahel, in that band of that area just south of the Sahara in Africa. There it is getting drier all the time, and they feel so much more the impact. Take Lake Chad in that area. When I was born, and that's maybe longer ago than you think, but when I was born in 65, that lake was still full. When I was at high school, the map on the wall of Africa showed two really huge lakes, Lake Victoria and Lake Chad. Now Lake Chad is at 10% of the size that it used to be. That is the kind of impact. Imagine here that whatever Lake Michigan would suddenly be at 10% of the size. That is the kind of impact they are dealing with. That is unfair. And the last thing that is unfair, well, there's many more, but the last thing I want to know, want you to know, is that our means of adaptation to climate change are so much more than their possibilities. We have the knowledge and the technology. So how do you deal with this? For a long time in the negotiations about climate change, this was one of the reasons why we didn't get there. Because the poorer countries in the world said, and you can say rightly so, the rich countries should start. So the very first treaty that we had about climate change, which is called the Kyoto Protocol, and that was only applicable for the rich countries, which the European countries said, well, fair enough, we believe that we should start, and later the poorer countries should come on board as well, because we are so much to blame. But you had a vote in Congress, in the Senate, here in the US, and 95 against 0 senators said, this is unfair. Climate change is so unfair. Why do we have to start and not those countries in the Sahel? So they all voted against. So this has been a very difficult issue to deal with for a long time. And then we tried in Copenhagen, we said, okay, we don't set those kind of strict rules, but we tried to get everybody on board, and that utterly failed. And finally, the diplomatic solution, which was found in what's called the Paris Agreement in late 2015, is which I think diplomatically is a masterpiece of diplomacy, where apart from one, all the countries in the world got on board and they said, now we are actually going to take action. It was less binding than originally was tried in the days of the Kyoto Protocol, but at least everybody is on board, and all of them said, including those countries that are much more victimized by climate change than you are here, they all said, okay, we're all going to do our best because this is so important, we can no longer wait. And that's the situation we are in now. You should see it this way. The urgency is so high. The house is on fire. Mm. And you're not going to waste time on discussing who has let the candles on and started the fire, or who should pay for the fire brigade. We all have to get on board and do our best. And that means, last comment here, that means that we, the Western, the rich countries, we have an obligation to help those countries. It is the problem that we created that is hitting them. So we need to share our knowledge, and we should do whatever we can to work together to tackle this problem. It's in all of our interest. So even if you only want to think about yourself interest, even then, which I'm not propagating here, but even then, it is in your own interest to work together with all the countries in the world to tackle this global problem.
Also, I think something that was great within the Paris Treaty was the fact that developed countries would have to provide support to developing countries. And I think that's something interesting that we've seen a lot in developing countries is the whole idea of leapfrogging technology. But you see this a lot in other sectors. So
I mean, we all had telephones that were hanging on walls with cords out of them. Most developing countries never even had those. They just went straight to iPhones. Most developing countries don't use credit cards. They use their phones to pay. So you see a lot of this leapfrogging going on. And so providing the support and the systems in order for that to occur, rather in the energy sector or in more climate-focused sectors, is really, really necessary. Something else that I think is a discussion that I've had with a lot of people here, as well as we have a lot over in our department at school, is the diversity of thought, opinion, and contribution to especially the science that is going on behind what is studying climate change. A lot of the climate models that we use to predict and look at future scenarios, and a lot of the original work has been done mostly by people in North America and in Europe. And that is leaving out the majority of the world. It is not including a lot of voices that need to be heard and need to be a part of the scientific discussion. Just in terms of not only developing these models and developing these understandings of future climate scenarios, but also in terms of the kind of way and the metrics that we use to see these scenarios. I was talking to someone the other day, and he was saying that he was working in the Middle East, and they were talking about the impact that maximum temperatures throughout the day would have on people in that region. And someone came up to him, and he was like, yeah, that's great, but, like, you forgot about humidity and the impact that humidity has on it. And so they went back and re-looked at everything, and the minute they included humidity, it completely transformed and made way more dramatic the impacts that climate change would be having on certain cities, and it kind of transitioned the way in which they were looking at things. You can also look at things like in Australia. If you just look at the change in temperature, you're going to have a lot of really hot days on one coast of Australia. But if you include the humidity, which is going to make it harder for people to recover, and they're not going to be able to adapt as well, with increased humidity, actually the opposite coast is going to be more impacted. So including those on-the-ground points of view and making sure that this diversity of opinions, including people in indigenous communities in the Arctic, is really, really critical.
Thank you. So I will apologize right now by saying that there are a lot of great questions coming in. We're not going to be able to get to the specifics of everyone's questions. With that in mind, though, I'm going to do my best to group some themes. I've got two planned here. The first of which, there have been a few coming in here that are asking about gender. Each of you have brought up in your prepared remarks different elements of this. Women in STEM fields, old men at the Antarctic Treaty negotiations. Can you speak maybe through the prism of your own experience about the importance of gender when taking on this theme of all hands on deck? Who would like to begin? Alexander?
Again, it's kind of injustice here. Climate change is often hitting women harder than men. Maybe not so much here in the Western world, but in many other countries, that is certainly the case. I spoke a couple of days ago about the example of the child brides, as they call it, in southern Africa, about in the country of Malawi, where the extreme climate is taking away the possibility for families to earn an income, and that parents are forced to kind of sell their children to be married at the age of 12 for a price like $25 to an old man. These children, and this is massive, we talk about hundreds of thousands of cases. That means that these children at 12 are robbed of their youth. They cannot go to school anymore. They they get children at the age of 12 or 13, and many of them. I mean, this is a horrible situation. I think the word married is absolutely wrongly chosen here. I think rape is much better to use in this case. These are massive numbers of how climate change is impacting women. The Drawdown Project, I don't know if you've heard about it. Drawdown is a group of dozens of scientists that came together a couple of years ago, and they still work together. And they came with the Drawdown Report, I think it was a bestseller in for the general audience as well, where they came with present-day existing policies and methodologies that you can... that we can use to keep climate change under the 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius that we want to stay under. First and foremost is an issue that many people don't think about daily. That is the combination of family planning as well as educating girls. If you educate girls up to the age of 18, on average, they will get 2 children. They are in a better position to raise these children. They will get more education, etc. If they leave school at the age of 12, for a number of reasons, I mentioned one, but another could be bad sanitary facilities, for instance, in many countries. If they leave school at the age of 12, on average, they will get a little bit more than 5 children. And they have they will have a bad future because there's not enough money to educate those kids, etc. So that's a vicious cycle going down. So the importance of providing knowledge and possibilities for family planning and combine that with educating girls, and in the meantime educate the boys as well, please, then that is something that really, really has a huge impact on climate change. So it's one of the good things you can do. There's so much more I could talk about the role of women in climate change, also in the positive side, what they're doing, but I would like to leave it here. Thanks.
So an interesting kind of clickbaity title that came out, I think it was like last week, was this, and it was on the news too, a lot of people were talking about it, was there was this research article about, they said, toxic masculinity and climate change. And so they were talking about this idea, and it's a really interesting, there's actually a research study, but the clickbait title was all about toxic masculinity. And so it was really picked up across media and kind of slammed for having this outlook. But the real idea behind this this piece was mostly looking actually at the fact that the way we've been approaching climate change treaties and working on climate change has been in a very historically uninclusive perspective. And so it's been not working very well so far. And so the question is, how do we move forward and adjust it so that it does work in the future? And it's been great getting more involved in sciences and seeing the growth of women in science. And I think that I like to shift that rhetoric from kind of climate change's impact on women to thinking about more so than how women can impact climate change, because, and this article really kind of brought that to light to me, is it's a really great opportunity. It's an unfortunate thing that this is at our hands, but especially for women who are, as Alexander said, more impacted both internationally and at the health level, at the economic level, by climate change. How then can this be an opportunity for women to get more included and to really shift that perspective and move towards being a part of the conversation? And I think overall it is, again, as I was talking about earlier, making sure that these voices are a part of the conversation, and making sure that women are more included at both the local level and the international level and the scientific level. Our department has a very fortunate 50-50 split of male to female graduate students. Professors, not so much, but that's something where you're seeing that generational shift. And also, I think there's, for me, one of the biggest impacts was a lot of my work in China. I ended up over in this city, Lanzhou, so it was close on the pronunciation. We were working in this small community in the grasslands, and the grasslands have been impacted by a combination of climate change as well as poor decisions by the government to kind of portion off rather than allow it for natural herding and grazing. And amongst these communities, there's been a huge struggle as the grasses have gone from 2 feet tall to 1 inch tall. And this is a region that has been kind of deemed the third pole because climate change is making it 2 to 3 degrees warmer, similar to what you're seeing in the Arctic as well. And it was really interesting talking to the communities there because the women have found a lot of their work impacted. And also, in order to kind of make up for the economic and health impacts of this changing climate in their area, a lot of the girls have had to stay behind and not attend school in order to help continue to have their family be able to literally put food on the table at night. So talking to these young 10-year-old girls who were not going to school and talking to these women who were really being impacted and working with them for months was really, really interesting, and it was really an opportunity for me and hopefully for other women, I think, thinking about this is kind of shifting that rhetoric and moving it towards more how can women be more involved in ensuring that the mistakes of the past are not the mistakes of the future.
Just to comment on Alexander's mention of family planning and education, I mean, I have heard countless times, there's lots of research that does show that the number one thing we can do to help with climate change, to help with overpopulation, to help with a lot of these global issues is to educate women across the world. So why wouldn't we do that? I mean, it just, for me, makes so much sense. In fact, people are like, man, if you want to put your money or put your energy towards one thing, put it towards that. So why wouldn't we do that? The second thing to reflect on, Lissa's comments on needing the diversity of perspectives. You've mentioned that multiple times. It is so true. These problems we're facing are global. They're huge. They're complex. Why wouldn't we want all the diverse perspectives we could possibly have, different worldviews as well as different gender views? And then the third thing to comment on is just, I mean, there are these continued hardships we've heard about of women in the world, what they're facing. However, I also think it's this amazing time to be a woman in science, a woman in policy. Things are changing so much. I was commenting, yes, there's a lot of older men, usually older Western men at the table at some of these meetings. However, that is changing. I mean, even the last time I went to one of these Antarctic Treaty meetings, the people were talking about needing gender balance, and that was amazing. That was the first time that was ever brought up in 2018. But we are talking about it. And even from my perspective, being a woman scientist, I've been on many Antarctic research trips, and it's so far, from my experience, always been men principal investigators, so men are the sort of top scientists on board. But the last trip I went on, it was still top scientists were men on board. However, there was this whole cohort of us in our mid-30s, women, who were just pooling together, and we made them very uncomfortable, these men scientists on board. They were calling us the hen house, and they were, like, really nervous about us. But, you know, I knew they were nervous because we were like, hey, we're taking over. Like, fine, you're there now, but give us another 10 years, and this vessel is going to be run by us women. So, So yeah, just to, there is so much hope. And I guess finally, just to end it with, I think that comes back around to, it is the responsibility of us to set the pace for the future and to make a path so that women can have the same opportunities that men do. And we can do it here in the West, and then we can do it elsewhere in the world. I've been to meetings now too where it's acceptable for women to wear their babies as they're presenting. That is awesome too. Like, things are just changing so much in terms of welcoming women and allowing them to be women and not sort of shaming them for choosing to be women as well as to be scientists. So that's all. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have about 15 minutes left. I'm going to try and engineer a question that brings in a lot of others that have come in, and then a final one which will open up to some of your concluding comments too. This one I'm going to anchor to a particular student comment, though there are a lot that are similar. Student comment and question: is there a good way to convince policymakers of committing to policy change that curbs carbon emissions, even when policymakers are speculative of the legitimacy of climate change as a threat? And so there are a number of sort of variations of this kind of question about essentially getting to maybe some of the reticent decision makers at various levels and scales. Feel free to, in your answer, to, you know, bring this into other arenas as well. Beyond climate change, that is.
Whoa. Where do I start on this one? Okay, there's a difference between the United States and the rest of the world. That's an inconvenient truth, but it is like that. Policymakers in Europe are convinced, you might find a few exceptions, but they're basically convinced that climate change is man-made. It's mostly by the burning of fossil fuels. It's mostly by CO2. And it's urgent and it's dangerous. Policymakers in the US are divided. Some believe in science, some believe in fiction. And so that changes the dynamics. This is the only country in the world that has said they are not going to follow the Paris Agreement. This is, by the way, the country that historically has put most greenhouse gases in the air, more than any other country in the world. You often hear Americans blame China because at this moment China is producing more greenhouse gases. So it's difficult, since as a diplomat I try to be nice for everybody, right? I'm not very good now. It's difficult to answer this question without pointing out this massive divide in how it is perceived. You in America are so much more a victim of a massive campaign by the fossil fuels economy, the fossil fuel business, to confuse you, as if the scientists in the world on climate change are not in full agreement on the basics of what is happening. Actually, climate change, it's not that difficult. It is 19th century knowledge. It is knowledge from the time that we weren't even aware that America was literally drifting away from Europe. It's now politically, but in those days, we didn't even know those kind of basic facts. If you now look at the map, you see that they fit together, right? The scientists didn't agree on those things. But the science already knew that if you burn a lot of fossil fuels, that you create this blanket around the world that keeps the heat in. It's incredible that in the 21st century, people still believe that the scientists are not in agreement. But many politicians do. I don't know if they really do believe it, or that it is in their personal interest, and that has to do a lot with the funding culture in politics, which is also different than the rest of the world, that it's in their personal interest that it's good to believe it. But I would like to leave it there, but I think it's good for you to hear from somebody that is not from the US, to hear that you are in a unique position, and you're also, as the most powerful country in the world, you're also in a unique position to make change if America would really join the ranks and would really put its full weight on tackling this global challenge that we are facing, that is urgent and that is an existential threat, it would make so much difference. We need America on board. We need all of you on board. You can't leave this to some other countries to solve. Thank you.
So I'm going to add on to that question and then also kind of tackle an addendum of a question that we got. So something I've kind of referenced to a little bit is why I ended up studying mostly air pollution. And that was because I saw it as a really good avenue to look at these issues, especially given the fact that all of these energy sources and other and our transportation is a combination source of carbon dioxide as well as air pollutants. And there's been a lot of discussion about the fact that in the U.S. right now we've had so much talk of a carbon tax, and it's not happening. And we've had so many discussions about, in the past more so cap and trade, it didn't go through. And so something that I have always kind of tried to look at from the perspective of how can we not only I've talked about this personal level of involvement, but also how can we approach climate change so that those who do not believe it is a threat can also get on board with changes. Because sometimes you cannot change someone's opinion. And so rather than spending all of our effort trying to change the opinion of people who may not change their opinion, why don't we approach it from a different point of view and try to bring to light the economic gains that we can make from transitioning to clean energy? Why don't we bring to light the health impacts that are happening right now because of air pollution and water pollution and things like that? So that for me has been always a side avenue. I think that coupled with that, you will eventually really have to incorporate a carbon tax or something like that, a much more climate change focused aspect. But if you can prove to people that it is possible to take these further steps without it only being because of climate change, knowing that it will also positively impact our climate, I think that is a very critical way of kind of coming and meeting in the middle and realizing that there are kind of these tensions that we can bring together. Another thing that was brought up is kind of when I kept on talking about bringing it to this personal level, and we talked about the issue of who's responsible. Mostly we were looking at the developed nations versus developing. But then there's also the issue of past generations versus younger generations, and who's taking on the burden of this future change. And it's the younger generations. They're going to be taking on a lot of the I hate using the word burden, actually, because I think it's a huge opportunity. And whenever we discuss this as if it is kind of a blame game, I think rather it is, yes, it is not the young generation's fault that this is a situation that they are in. But at the same time, if this is such a critical issue and it needs to be approached as soon as we possibly can, and it needs a lot of investment in science, technology, businesses need to get on board. And if we're able to, as this younger generation, move forward and show these improvements and really bring to light what we can do with such a tough situation, I think that's where kind of those lessons for those other generations who have kind of created this existing issue come in, especially when you think about those who do not believe that this is a problem. A lot of it can come through solutions and proof, because words can say a lot, but I think a lot of us were probably brought up, my parents would always say, you know, teach by example. So don't just say the words, but do it. So the younger generations are really going to have to almost reverse teach by example and move forward and show anyone who's not believing in these issues that through their actions, this is something that we can tackle.
Just a couple quick things to comment on. One is that I know there is this issue that some governments don't believe in climate change. I think we need to make clear that there is scientific consensus on the issue, so this isn't even something that you can believe in or not, and whether or not people believe in it, it's happening, and I think we need a very clear narrative on that. Like, we have consensus, it is happening, whether or not you believe it, it's happening, and we're feeling the effects of it. And to that, I think we all can take a role in driving the narratives and making sure that we make those things clear. I think incentives are important. Countries and individuals, everyone will act based on being incentivized to act. So making clear this idea that it's good business to actually, you know, innovate and to use cleaner technologies, I think is really important. And then the last thing, just to comment on, reflecting on some of my experience in science communication, is that if you actually know who your audience is, you can reach people, even deniers. If you haven't heard of the work of Catherine Hayhoe, I recommend you look her up. She's an evangelical Christian who is a climate scientist, and she finds amazing ways to communicate, even to audiences who don't believe in climate change, about environmental change, about extreme weather, finding the right language to talk to different communities. If it's a religious community, she finds ways to do that as well. So just knowing your audience, let's all change the narrative, and we can change this thing. So.
Great. So unfortunately, we are short on time, so this will be kind of a last set of questions. You all prefigured it a little bit in your responses to the last one. But rather than focusing in on the diagnosis of, you know, those who are reticent to move forward on these issues, the last set of questions I want to focus on are about how to effectively move forward. There's a student question that talks about how to bridge the gap between science, policy change, and trusted local citizens, asking about tangible change in communities. And this can be related to a number of other questions that came in, such as how might we best encourage positive actions in spite of our government? How can you provide some real solutions to implement to save the planet and humanity given the current political climate? But then this last one, how do you best build local and global coalitions that can work together on initiatives to be successful? So maybe that's an opportunity with the 3 minutes we have left for a minute each to comment on that positive moving forward type of set of questions.
Thanks. I'm so bad in speaking 1 minute. Let me give it a try. The business industry can be really creative. Palm oil, the five biggest businesses in the world that create palm oil, that use palm oil, they got together and they just wrote on kind of the back of an envelope, like, in 1 year from now, we will no longer cut primal forests to create palm oil plantations. Another example, the youth, already mentioned briefly before, Greta Thunberg, a girl of just 15, strikes, stops going to school and starts the climate strike in front of the Swedish parliament. Just 9 months later, you see the birth of an international movement where 1.5 million students skip school to raise alarm about what's really going on. These kind of examples are wonderful. There's so much that you can do yourself. Get organized in some way. So, for instance, one thing I'm doing now, I'm also the policy director of the EDRC in Brussels. One of the things I'm doing now in America and in Canada while I'm here is setting up a transatlantic dialogue on environment, because we believe that we actually need to work together between Europe and between North America to work together on these environmental issues. So I had the first meeting in Brussels 2 or 3 weeks ago. I had last week a first meeting in Washington, D.C. And this is something where I hope to find more support for, to get more people on board. That's one of those initiatives. This itself is not going to change the world, but if we have many of these kind of initiatives where people come together to change the world, we can really make it a better one. And it's a beautiful journey to be on board there, to be innovative, to be on the winning side of tackling this beast of climate change. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to answer this with a cool example of there's this NGO in China that I worked a lot with, and they developed this application on your phone that you can use. And their main goal of that was they knew that everyone sat on the subway for an hour every morning and played games on their phone. And so they were like, well, let's use the phone as a way to communicate with the public. And so this phone app initially just kind of told you what the air pollution was in your neighboring area. And so that made that information readily available to everyone. And then you saw them incorporate this really cool component that was interactive. So a lot of our factories that we get all of our goods from in America are located in China, and they pollute a lot and have a lot of carbon emissions. And so what they did was they created this tab on the app where you could report if you saw a factory near your hometown, because a lot of these are near cities. If you saw a factory that you thought was polluting, and you felt, or some people even began bringing out their own little monitors, and monitoring became this really big movement. And so if you could take a picture and report it, and they would send someone, each city, they set up a local kind of consultant, and these people would go out and check. Eventually the government got on board with this and found out about it, and the government started going out and checking, and this became a huge bottom-up way for the government to check on polluting industries. And then it hit international level when Apple and Nike found out that their facilities that they were using were on this list of blacklisted factories that this app created, and they would blacklist any factories that had been polluting and exceeding emission standards. And Apple and Nike stopped using those factories, or they required them to transition and start and report their monitoring. And so it totally transitioned this entire realm of factories. And I think I'll leave it at that, but I think that's a really good example of how you can kind of bring it, combination of the scientists, citizens, and businesses to the international level.
Thank you. And pressing against the end of our session, Cassandra with a final comment.
No, it's good. Final comment is just what inspires me the most is that, so I teach here at CU in environmental studies, and my students are pissed. They're pissed about climate change. They're pissed about this not burden or burden that they have inherited from past generations, but they don't know what to do. And the big thing I think we all need to do is to have hope. I think back to Martin Luther King, and if he had said, I have a nightmare, would we be in the world we have today? And it was a nightmare, right? But he dreamed something different, and I think we all just have to collectively dream a different future for ourselves.
Thank you. Thank you all the panelists. Thank you all for coming, and I wish you well for the rest of the